So what you want to do is always expand your market, expand the production. It's always a net economic benefit for the United States, no matter what product you're looking at.
Considering an end to the oil export ban. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage City officials work to get the port expansion project back on track.
Determine what went wrong with construction, who's responsible for what went wrong, what is the best path forward.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying Alaska dealers with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser heaters for more than 26 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through PicClickGive or contributing to a college savings plan. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Exxon and Chevron have made major contributions to a campaign that wants to preserve a controversial oil tax law that passed this year, according to recent filings with the Alaska Public Offices Commission. Exxon gave $350,000 to the group Vote No on One in December, matching contributions previously made by fellow North Slope producers BP and ConocoPhillips. Chevron, which has a smaller footprint in Alaska, gave $150,000. Vote No on One was created in October. Their goal is to defeat a referendum that would repeal Governor Sean Parnell's signature oil tax system, which caps the rate at 35% per barrel and amounts to a tax cut when oil prices are high. The law's supporters argue it will spur production on the North Slope, while critics have characterized it as a giveaway to industry. So far, the oil industry has put $1.6 million toward fighting the tax referendum, and most of that money has been spent on advertising. Only one group from outside the oil industry has contributed to Vote No on One. The Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce gave $10,000 to their campaign on December 20th. Referendum sponsors have not had the same financial success. Vote Yes, Repeal the Giveaway has taken $90,000 from small donors, and they spent most of their funds on their signature gathering campaign. The referendum is scheduled to appear on the August primary ballot. In Washington, at both the White House and in Congress, 2014 brings changes to the politics of energy that are likely to affect Alaska. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski is starting the year by reconsidering the crude oil export ban. The ban has been in place since the Arab oil embargo of the 1970s. Then, as now, supporters say it lessens American dependence on foreign oil. But oil production is surging in the lower 48 now, and imports are declining. Rayola Dewar of the American Petroleum Institute says not allowing sales overseas may be keeping some oil locked in, suppressing revenue and job growth.
So what you want to do is always expand your market, expand the production. It's always a net economic benefit for the United States, no matter what product you're looking at.
Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz has also suggested it's time to rethink the ban. Ban proponents, though, say allowing exports could raise fuel prices for American consumers. Senator Murkowski is planning to release a white paper on the subject next week, followed by a speech at the Brookings Institution. Murkowski is the top Republican on the Senate Energy Committee. This year, chairmanship of the panel is likely to pass from Ron Wyden of Oregon to one of the oil industry's favorite Democrats, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana. That could mean a new pro-development direction for the committee. Murkowski energy spokesman Robert Dillon says the senator has worked with Wyden on common goals for hydropower parks and public lands.
With Senator Landrieu, they share a common interest when it comes to oil and gas exploration and production. So their interests dovetail there nicely.
Together, for instance, Landrieu and Murkowski have pressed for federal revenue sharing for states with offshore production. Meanwhile, environmentalists are hoping John Podesta can slow that momentum. He was President Clinton's chief of staff, and he's rejoining the White House as a counselor to the president on energy and climate. Ethan Manuel of the Sierra Club says Podesta is likely to pay a lot of attention to Alaska.
With President Clinton, he was pretty active on protecting the Arctic Refuge, was a big backer of that, was a strong champion of the Tongass National Forests and the entire forest system with a roadless rule. So on a couple of really important Alaska issues, he was very, very active in the past, and we expect him to continue to be active now with the Obama administration.
One of the big Alaska issues facing the administration is the scope of future lease sales for the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. Podesta wrote an op-ed a year ago claiming there's no safe way to drill offshore in the Arctic. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The engineering firm CH2M Hill has been selected to manage the troubled Port of Anchorage project. The project was shut down after construction problems a few years ago and remains tied up in lawsuits. But today, officials said it could be back on track again this year. KSK's Daisha Eaton has the story.
The role of the project manager will be to oversee the day-to-day operations of the construction project moving forward, setting timelines and benchmarks, and selecting and supervising the work of subcontractors. CH2M Hill will not be involved in designing or building the port. On the top floor of City Hall, Mayor Dan Sullivan said over the past few years, his administration has been working to do several things.
Determine what went wrong with construction, who's responsible for what went wrong, what is the best path forward, including a review of the design parameters, and then going forward, putting together a team to make sure that as this project proceeds into the future, that we've got the right team on board.
The right team, Mayor Sullivan said, is from CH2M Hill, a Colorado-based engineering firm with offices in Anchorage. The port project was started back in 2003 under Mayor George Wersch and Port Director Bill Sheffield. The design was approved in 2006 under Mayor Mark Begich. The Sullivan administration has led the push to get the municipality reimbursed for its losses. The U.S. Department of Transportation Maritime Administration managed the previous project. CH2M Hill released a report earlier this year saying the previous project had failed because of a patented open-cell sheet pile design that crumpled and separated during construction. CH2M Hill purchased the now-defunct Vico Corporation, which was involved in the work that had the problems, and is now party to a lawsuit by the city. But Mayor Sullivan says that won't be a problem.
We think we can compartmentalize that lawsuit. Again, it goes back to Vico before they were acquired by CH2M Hill. So we're confident that we'll be able to keep the lawsuit separate from any progress going forward on the construction and design.
Sullivan says the next steps will be selecting a new design and contractors to build it. CH2M Hill was selected, Sullivan says, for their expertise and experience in building ports in areas with seismic activity. Stacy Jones, a vice president with CH2M Hill who will lead the team, says unlike the Maritime Administration, which was criticized for managing the project from afar, CH2M Hill will work closely with the Port of Anchorage, setting up an office right in the port to develop the new project.
I believe one of the reasons why CH2M Hill has been selected is because of our extensive experience in managing projects. We are ranked number one in the U.S. for project management as well as environmental management. We have the skills and the tools and the expertise to be able to do this.
She added that the previous open cell sheet pile design will not be used again, but didn't specify what design her firm favors. The contract with CH2M Hill is for $30 million over 5 years, with the option for two extensions at $12 million each. Design and engineering work is anticipated to take 18 months to 2 years, with construction likely beginning again in 2016. The selection of CH2M Hill will go before the Anchorage Assembly for approval at its January 14th meeting. The municipality has been investigating problems with the port project since they arose in 2009. They've spent upwards of $300 million public dollars on the project so far and are requesting $100 million more from the legislature this year. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, working to expand the Nome Cemetery.
The immediate plan is to take care of the existing ones and make sure they're adequately marked. And then from there on, continue down the road to design the new expanded cemetery.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. Since 1978, the Older Persons Action Group has been the publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families. They now offer a digital version online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Members of a legislative task force clashed over funding as they worked on a blueprint for addressing education in Alaska. The disagreement came over whether the House Task Force on Sustainable Education should recommend bringing state funding down from current levels. Member Brad Keithley advocated for including such language in their draft, arguing the public needs to recognize the state is spending itself off a fiscal cliff. But Andrew Helcrow, a former state legislator and current president of the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, argued that such a statement makes everything we're doing here irrelevant. He said the panel hasn't even really addressed what an adequate funding level is and said it makes no sense to talk about cutting spending when the panel hasn't looked into investing in areas like pre-kindergarten that might cost more now but save later. The language was revised during a Tuesday meeting to say the public should be made aware that education spending is not sustainable. Helcrow was the only member of the 8-person group to vote against the recommendation. A new Alaska State Trooper crime unit in Matanuska-Susitna Borough area has already nabbed its first criminals. In mid-December, troopers announced a new property crimes unit to start work on January 1st of this year. On New Year's Day, troopers arrested 2 men from Palmer, 22-year-old Luke Mackey and 22-year-old Elmanda Arbaca, for stealing an ATM from a local business. Megan Peters is a trooper spokeswoman.
There was a break-in at a shop out in the valley. Somebody broke the front window, essentially took a freestanding ATM from the establishment and drove away. Our patrol troopers responded to that initially. Information was given to the criminal suppression unit, and they were able to track down suspects and make arrests on that.
The machine was taken from a business on the Palmer-Wasilla Highway. The ATM and all the money it contained were recovered after an alarm tipped off law enforcement officials. The 2 men are being held on $5,000 bail each. The incident is the 2nd ATM theft in about a week. On December 21st, an ATM containing nearly $5,000 in cash was stolen from a Palmer business.
It would really be too soon to say on whether or not there is a connection between this recent incident and the one that happened a little while ago.
The new trooper unit began work on Wednesday. Peter says the property crimes unit was formed to counter the increasing number of thefts in the Mat-Su. A recent draft report prepared by the Fairbanks-based company Northern Land Use Research Alaska found what is likely about 100 unmarked graves in Nome's cemetery. The company conducted a ground-penetrating radar analysis of the area around Nome's existing graveyard as part of a planned expansion for the grounds. Josie Banks is Nome city manager and says the cemetery expansion is steadily moving forward. Zachariah Hughes from KNOM has the story.
The survey was part of Nome's effort to expand its burial grounds. Josie Banky is the city manager and says the cemetery expansion is steadily moving forward.
You know, since acquiring about 16 acres of land back in 2005, the city council's budgeted funding over the years to provide necessary works to do survey, to plat the land, to locate property boundaries, and also to locate existing grave sites.
Steps for the expansion started almost a decade ago, and in the last 2 years, the final design plans were put into place.
This past year, we were able to complete that field work and also come up with a conceptual design for the layout of the new expanded area with roads and trails, and also a concept for the plots in order to develop the site.
A report issued by the Bristol Engineering Services Corporation from 2012 outlines an eventual northward expansion to accommodate a planned addition of 3,500 plots. Banky expects that phase of the project to be completed in the next 3 to 5 years. The city of Nome pursued the GPR analysis to make sure the expansion wouldn't develop over any unidentified plots. The survey works by collecting topographical information through rebounded electrical signals. When the data was analyzed, it turned up 96 anomalies. that is, disturbances in the earth consistent with human burial practices. But the draft report's author, Robert Bowman, said in an email that it's important to keep in mind there's no conclusive evidence that the sets of anomalies are graves. It could be any number of things, from wiring to old piping and stuff like that. But given that the depths of the disturbances, 45 to 180 centimeters down, are consistent with hand-dug graves made during different seasons, and given that most of the plots are clustered around the old Catholic part of Nome Cemetery, it seems safe to assume that at least a few are likely associated with human burial. Banky says knowing where those sites are will determine the next steps in the planning process.
The immediate plan is to take care of the existing ones and make sure they're adequately marked. And then from there on, you know, continue down the road to design the new expanded cemetery.
The most likely explanation for so many unmarked graves is that their location and markers were overgrown decades ago. For most of its existence, Nome Cemetery has received little to no professional maintenance, and older material records of burials were at the whims of the elements. Bowman said that given the freeze and thaw of the ground, coupled with the harsh winds and lots of moisture in the air, organic markers like wood wouldn't have lasted for very long. More recent efforts by volunteers restored many of those markers, and seasonal work has helped with the upkeep of the grounds during the warmer months. But there's still no city office that's in charge of the cemetery, and the current expansion effort has depended on collaboration between volunteers and the city council, spearheaded by the city manager's office. As the expansion moves forward, Banky says, one of the most important steps ahead is securing consistent budgetary funding for upkeep of what's already there. For KNOM in Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Alaska Air National Guard was called to Bristol Bay last night to help look for an overdue snow machiner from the Nooshiegak River village of Killigannik. State troopers say 25-year-old Devin McDowell left Killigannik around 2 yesterday afternoon, heading for Leavelock via New Stuyahok. McDowell never made it to Leavelock, and someone notified authorities around 9 p.m. New Stuyahok volunteer searchers scoured the Leavelock Trail but found no snow machine tracks. The troopers asked the Rescue Coordination Center to join the search by air, making use of better night vision capabilities. Guard spokesman Sergeant Edward Egerton says the RCC accepted the mission just before 11 p.m.
Then the Alaska National Guard sent out an HC-130 King aircraft and a HH-60 PAPOC helicopter, both with teams of pararescue men, and then they flew out to the area and conducted the search at night.
Crews aboard a PAPOC found McDowell a little more than 5 miles east of Killigannik, not on the trail to Leavelock. He had apparently lost his way, but was reportedly in good shape and was flown back to Killigannik. The National Guard credits McDowell with leaving a good trip plan that helped get the search underway. Authorities encourage all travelers to do that on every trip out.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska,
and by
Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying Alaska dealers with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser heaters for more than 26 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Climate change and increased Arctic activity are projected to offset declines in toxic human emissions. A recent study from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology predicts warmer temperatures will cause contaminants stored in the earth to re-emit back into the atmosphere. In addition, increases in Arctic vessel traffic and oil and gas drilling will multiply pollutant concentrations. KNOM's Anna Rose MacArthur reports from Nome.
Polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. These pollutants release from burning oil, coal, and wood. They are carcinogenic, take a long time to break down, and they accumulate in the Arctic. And though human emissions of these contaminants are expected to decrease over the next several decades, climate change and increased Arctic activity are projected to partially offset this decline. Though largely discharged at mid-latitude, these semi-volatile pollutants join the atmosphere and transport across continents. Then, entering the Arctic, the toxins condense under the cold temperatures and fall out of the atmosphere. Carrie Friedman is a postdoctoral researcher at MIT and lead author on the study.
So you get this, what's called a grasshopper phenomenon, where pollutants just keep on making jumps northward into cold regions where they can condense and then accumulate.
The Arctic acts as a repository for these toxins, and small shifts in concentration, Friedman says, make a big impact. So by measuring the changing ratio of these pollutants in the Arctic, scientists can evaluate global emissions. Furthermore, they can determine if the toxins stem from human production or from rising temperatures causing these pollutants to re-emit from the Earth.
We've found that the Arctic, because it's so sensitive to these small changes, it can be used as sort of a place to keep an eye on how the world is reacting to changes in emissions and changes in our weather.
Friedman says these pollutants are not yet a health concern for the Arctic, but as accumulation continues, temperatures increase, and shipping and drilling multiply, they could soon become one. So with pollutant levels predicted to escalate in the Arctic, this study establishes a baseline of current toxin levels. As those numbers shift, scientists can determine how increases in Arctic activity are adding to those ratios.
We expect pH emissions to go up quite a bit in the Arctic because of the projected activities happening there as ice breaks up, like increased shipping, increased looking for oil and gas. So this was a way to sort of get a baseline of how much pH is coming from a long-distance transport versus locally as we move into the future.
The next step for this research, Friedman says, is studying another type of persistent organic pollutant, manufactured POPs, and how they behave under future climate and emission simulations, and how those chemicals transport through ocean currents. Reporting from KNOM in Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Matanuska Susitna Borough drivers run down hundreds of moose each year on their travels to and from Anchorage. Now, a targeted hunt allows winter hunting to reduce the number of moose near roadways. The hunt was established by the State Board of Game in 2011. Palmer Area State Wildlife Biologist Todd Rinaldi says the hunt is targeting nuisance moose.
Whether it's an injured moose that had an issue with breaking an ankle or was involved in an automobile collision and is spending a lot of time around humans, it might be a cow and a calf that's excessively aggressive, or maybe a moose that's been harassed by dogs and has since become more defensive around people.
Nuisance moose tend to hang out around cleared roadways or in people's backyards. When moose congregate around highway corridors, motorists can be injured or killed when they hit the 900-plus pound animals. Rinaldi says motorists kill 280 moose each year, but during winters of extremely deep snow, that number can double. Rinaldi says more than 1,000 hunters have signed up for this year's winter hunt, which starts on January 6th. 200 permits will be issued for Unit 14A and an additional 100 permits for Unit 14B. Each week, 8 hunters will be assigned to a designated road corridor where moose vehicle collisions are high. Only shotguns and bows can be used.
Some of these hunt areas that we've designated as high areas of moose collisions are actually on the edge of city limits or in neighborhoods and developed neighborhoods. So we use shotguns, 10-gauge and 12-gauge only, because of the reduced velocity, as well as bow and arrow, so that if the opportunity arose, we could direct hunters into some of these more developed areas or some of these areas where firearms are restricted.
He says officials collect data indicating areas of high collision rates from the state and further analyze those areas for hunt's suitability. Last winter's hunt harvested 148 moose. Rinaldi says Unit 14A is overpopulated and the extra hunt keeps the population down. Hunters on private land must have the permission of the landowner. The department and Alaska wildlife troopers will conduct random checks to ensure hunters comply with permit conditions and conduct themselves in a safe manner. As fish managers attempted to preserve the Yukon River king salmon last summer, commercial chum fishermen tried out some new gear. They used dip nets and beach seine gear by emergency order during the many king salmon closures. They brought in nearly 200,000 fish, but some say that's not enough for their income or for the future of the fishery. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
A proposal from the Yukon Delta Fisheries Development Association would allow purseine gear. They argue that the dip nets used last summer are inefficient and too many chum are escaping to spawn. The Board of Fish earlier this month found that it is indeed an emergency by a 4-3 vote that added the proposal to their March agenda. Gene Sandone is a former state biologist and consultant for YDFDA, that's the group pushing the gear change. He says last summer's experiment was a good start, but it doesn't fully address the economic or biological needs.
The dip nets, I think, prevented a disaster. They are extremely inefficient gear. Participation was fairly low throughout the mid portion of the run.
Over 1.6 million summer chums were missed in the harvest this year, and a good 2.6 million were counted as escapement. Sandone's research says that too many chums escaping upriver could be detrimental to future runs. The return curve drops off as you approach 2 million.
But because basically limitations in the Yukon, if you put 2 million fish on the spawning grounds, you may get 2 million back. So it's basically a return per spawner of one or even less. So you may actually get less fish back than you put on the spawning grounds.
YDFDA and Fish and Game experimented with purse seines last summer, all powered by hand. There's not a history of that gear type on the Yukon.
We said, why not? Let's give it a try, see if it's doable, because we had no idea whether we could do it in the river or not with the current and the tides and the snags. But I think that we proved that we could do it, and we want to give it a try. We want to harvest these chum salmon and allow the kings to just go upriver after they're released.
Sandone points to plans on the Columbia River in Washington for banning gillnets and using purse seines instead. That allows for the release of king salmon without too much stress. Sandone says he believes the Board of Fish wants to do something to help the Yukon fishermen.
Based upon the test fishing that we did last year, I'm convinced that that we can release any non-target fish alive back into the river. And with purse seines, they're much more efficient than dip nets, and I suspect that we could put a dent into the large surplus of summer chum salmon next year if the board approves the proposal.
Lower Yukon commercial fishermen could stand a benefit. Last year, they earned under $2 million in the summer chum fishery, and they gave up more than $4 million in foregone harvests. I'm Ben Matheson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Zachariah Hughes and Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Ben Matheson in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. Public Education Health Trust, formerly NEA Alaska Health Plan, delivers cost-effective health plans for Alaska families. They help Alaska's educational professionals, from school bus drivers to teachers, manage their health plan benefits efficiently. Public Education Health Trust provides members with low-cost plans, more choices, and local control, advocating for 17,000 Alaskans and their health care needs. This message sponsored by Public Education Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.